The stuff on.
I've never seen.
We're on. Alrighty, welcome to the whatever it is, September 22nd, 2006 meeting of the Senate Interim Committee on Business and Transportation. We've got a full agenda today. What are we starting with, Patrick?
Mr. Chair, the Department of Transportation, Paul Mather, is going to give us a projects update.
That's welcome, Paul.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator. I'm just going to give you a quick update on a few projects as I usually do. Before I start, I just want to point out what is left in front of you there. Is for sure we put together our Jobs and Transportation Act project. This is a very limited edition, but it's really just a highlighting information that we're going to put out over the next several months on many of these major projects that I'm going to talk about today and that we're finishing up, just to illustrate that these aren't just transportation projects. They are important projects for the community from a business standpoint, from a congestion standpoint, and all the other elements that these projects mean to people, to communities, to just people's daily lives. So I just give that to you, just a little bit of a background, just so when you see more information, we got videos we're putting up, social media, other things we're going to be putting out on these projects. This limited edition pamphlet that you have there just kind of highlights the projects that we're going to highlight in information sharing. So I'm going to go through just several projects to give you a few updates on things. I'm going to start with Sunrise Corridor. Project I think I talk about every time I'm here, and this will probably be the last time that I talk about it because the project is wrapped up and finished and open to traffic. I'm sure many of you that commute through 205 have noticed that this project has been completed. It provides an extension of the Milwaukee Expressway around the Clackamas business area. It provides much better access for Fred Meyer's other distribution centers in that area. And I'm already hearing from people, I don't know if you experience this, but as you drive 205, just how much better just the congestion on 205 is, not just in this area, but a lot of anecdotal information. We're gathering traffic information and should have some report in a few months just to kind of quantify that stuff, but we're already seeing a great benefit from this. Here's a picture of the interchange. You'll see the 205 bikeway that works through there. The new connection of 82nd Drive and 82nd Avenue, and then the extension and of the Sunrise Corridor. Had a nice event back in June to do a ribbon cutting on this project. It's a project that's been around for a long time and talked about for a long time. In fact, in my very early part of my career, I actually worked on one of the original studies on this project. So it was gratifying for me too to be at this event and see this project completed.
But more to do on it.
Yes, so this is phase one, and we have phase two. We have phase two yet to go and more work. This is just kind of the first phase of this project. Another one I thought I'd just highlight out in the Forest Grove area on Highway 47, just north of Forest Grove or Bort Road. We had several tragic fatalities in this area, and one that we've been working with Washington County on, partnering to deliver a safety improvement, but it's going to be the first roundabout that we have on the state highway system in a rural setting, a high-speed roundabout. Washington County, as you may know, in that area has several on their system, and we've partnered with them from a design standpoint to make sure that they're working the same as Washington County's. And we've worked extensively with the trucking industry. We went up to the Expo Center and laid this out, and they brought their big trucks in with our cones and so forth to make sure our design was going to fit for the types of loads that go through this area.
Just a second, Paul.
Thank you. High-speed roundabout. Could you explain that? I've never heard that term.
Can you
hit that at 55?
Yes, and so you'll see, if you look at this photograph in the upper part of the road here, you'll see that we actually jog the traffic right before you get to the roundabout to slow people down and recognize that you're coming up to a roundabout. So there's things in the design that you will recognize. And again, it follows the pattern of the high-speed roundabouts that the county has on their system in the same way. And they work very efficiently, especially in these rural settings. I'm sure Senator Riley has experienced those.
I have. Thank you. And they work really well. I I come down the back way from Hillsboro, and there's a roundabout just north of Shoals, and that really works well. It's a big improvement. Before that went in, coming that way quite often, we'd have backup of traffic maybe, you know, a quarter mile long at that intersection. Now there's none.
Good. Yeah, a nice safety improvement.
4x8 political signs in there.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, there's roundabouts on Stafford Road, just south of 205, that seem to work pretty well. I get up there quite often. Is this going to be similar to that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, yes, it'll be a similar to that. I'm not as familiar with that one compared to our design, but there'll be a similar design.
I think three roundabouts.
Yeah.
When you leave I-205 and you're heading south on Stafford Road,
right.
And I think there's
right.
three of them you come to.
Right.
Okay.
They're pretty big.
So our project on US 20, between Corvallis and Newport, what we call the Pioneer Mountain Eddyville project, just to give you an update on that project. It continues to go well. Just as a reminder, this project's been around for a long time as we've dealt with slides in the area and other complications from this project. But it does cut off 5 or 6 miles off of your trip from Corvallis to Newport. It also opens this route up to truck traffic that's restricted now from the GP mill in Toledo. It's a project that's been long awaited for, and we're literally within weeks of opening the project. This is what the project looked like just a few weeks ago. You see actually pavement on this photograph. You've seen me show these slides, I think, virtually every time as I give you updates and this project progresses. We're just about finished with what we call final lift paving on the project. The last piece of the project we're working on, and we'll continue to work on through next year, even after we have the new alignment open, will be the transition on the west end of the project, where the new alignment you'll see in this photograph coming from the right with that bridge across the railroad there. And in the inset, you see the sharp curve that we're putting the new alignment right into that sharp curve. And so we're working to alleviate that. The other thing we're doing as we do this excavation in this transition is we're taking that material back onto the project. And we're using it to increase our factor of safety on the slides itself. So we have to put that material some way. And so it's really been a kind of a coordinated dance, so to speak, with the contractor working with the paving to make sure we can get it open, but we can get off-road trucks in there to move this material and use that material in a strategic way back on the project.
Is there an estimate of how much time it will save commuting from Newport over to Corvallis?
I don't know a time. I know a distance, 5 or 6 miles you're going to take off your trip. So if you're, but in that section, you're not even traveling at 60, 55, 60 miles an hour. You're traveling less than that with those sharp curves. So conservatively 5 minutes, probably more realistically, is probably closer to 10. So here's our announcement of our ribbon cutting ceremony. We're calling Come Play on the Grade. We're going to allow the community, Newport, Corvallis, Eddyville, just come out and see the project. It's been something that's been going on kind of back off the highway. You haven't really been able to see what we've been doing on the project, and we're just going to open the project up and allow people a week from Saturday to come out and enjoy the ribbon cutting of the project. The actual project will probably open towards the middle of October as we get the final striping and paving done. We just want to get the ribbon cutting kind of out of the way, so as soon as we're done, we're able to open this to traffic. Sheep Creek project. This is a smaller project, but it's been a project with a lot of impacts since we've closed the highway just east of Sweet Home on Highway 20. This bridge across Sheep Creek, as you see in the inset there, the footing of the far end of that bridge sits on a landslide. And so we've been shimming the bridge up and doing different maintenance techniques, but it finally came down to we had to replace the the far span of that bridge, and the only way to do that in this remote area was to close the highway. We knew that was going to have an impact on the community, impact on that area from logging and other impacts. We put together a low bid project that we incentivized and de-incentivized the contract. The contractor had a $14,000 a day incentive to get done early and a $14,000 a day penalty for late from the schedule. The contractor finished the project 2 weeks early, so received almost a $200,000 bonus for getting the project done. Done early.
Before you move on,
turned out well. Gerard?
Yeah, I just want to point out this stretch of road between Sweet Hope and where it merges with, I think it's 396, the road from Eugene.
126.
Yeah, where that stretch of road really needs some major improvements. It's we're talking a really bad stretch of road. And the reason I think that you also want to do it, we've just improved it's Highway 20. So you just improved it from Corvallis to Newport, and that can become the major thoroughfare from Bend all the way to the coast. So I think that stretch of road is extremely important, and we need to start work and then have more projects on Highway 20.
Just to give you a quick update on the project in Eugene, I-5 Beltline. This is one, again, I've talked about a lot. We're on phase four of this project. The light blue is the work that is currently underway. This is the last phase of the project. As you remember, we've scaled this project back or used some of our practical design techniques to save money on this project and move it to the next project I'm going to talk about at Delta and Beltline. But finishing up the loop ramp there, as you see the light blue in the quadrant from, let me see, directions right, eastbound Beltline to northbound I-5, finishing up that off-ramp and loop ramp there, connecting up the last pieces of the bike path, finishing the sound wall, and the southbound on-ramp from Beltline to I-5 as well.
So Paul, I've wondered how this thing was going to work. The work that's going on now, will that fly over I-5 and then loop back under if you're going north?
So what we'll do right at this point of the project, there'll be one off-ramp. As you want to get to I-5 from Beltline, it'll be signed as one off-ramp, and then there'll be a decision point where they either go north or south on I-5. And so the southbound ramp you'll see there in blue, and then the northbound will turn into that loop ramp you see as you go across. You go underneath the flyover, but over I-5, and then you do a loop and come back underneath Beltline and go north on the freeway.
So you will go. It will be over the top of I-5 and under the existing flyover.
Yes.
Then.
Yep. Yep. And it does that today. If you do that today, but you're doing it on the Beltline structure,
right,
this will give you a separate way to do that. So back at your decision point for your off-ramp, there'll be one off-ramp for I-5, and then there'll be a separate decision point for north or south on I-5, just to facilitate the movement of traffic through there. Here's some of the work for that footing for that crossover that'll be parallel to the Beltline structure.
Gotcha.
So the savings that we had on that project, we're able to move to another JTA project that originally was just ramp metering project, but we've expanded now with additional money to actually do some relief here. This is probably, at least in my mind, the most congested point in the Eugene-Springfield yeah. area, and it would be not the total solution. We have, a very large project here, but this is a good first step that we're able to do. We're out meeting with the public this fall with a couple of public meetings to get this project underway. We're probably in 2018 for construction, open in 2019 timeframe for this work. But it's really just reconfiguring the ramps out there and making the interchange work more efficiently. And basically, it's same configuration, but just kind of improving some of those connections more simply.
Coming off the I'm trying to get my bearings here.
So the biggest change we're making is down here at this interchange here, the intersection here. So today you go underneath as you're headed east on the Beltline, and you take this loop ramp.
Right.
Up here, we're going to take this loop ramp out, and there'll be one off ramp here. And again, that decision point whether you want to go south on Delta or you come up now to a signal we'll put here, and go north.
You're going to put a signal there?
Yeah, and people have that reaction. but it's actually going to work a lot better, and that's part of what we're going to go out with the public and explain why it's going to work a lot better than this really tight loop ramp that's going to that causes a lot of the conflicts that we see today.
Aren't you going to have a lot of backup on that off-ramp there during the commute time?
Mr. Chair, we may have some. Again, this is not the ultimate solution, but it's going to be significantly better than what we have out there today.
Really? Okay.
I would suggest the state senator of that area explain to everybody down there how that
happened. That doesn't happen to be in my district.
Oh, it does.
Winning.
So another project I've talked about that we're just ready to have a ribbon cutting on this project as well, another JTA project you'll see highlighted in the handout that I had, Fern Valley Interchange. This is just south of Medford. The significance about this project, it's a new type of interchange that we're using, first time in Oregon, actually first time in the West Coast, but it's not unique to the United States. There's over 100 of these throughout the country. They're just kind of just coming to the West Coast. But as I've explained to those other interchanges, this one is probably the most unique one that we have in the state, in that if you're coming towards the interchange from Phoenix, you'll come up to a traffic signal here, cross over and go on the other side of the road, come here to a signal and cross back over. What that allows you to do is to have a right turn here to get on the freeway. Once you're crossed over, rather than making a left, you now essentially make a left with no conflict, or what feels like a right turn. And so all your turns, whether they're left or right, have no conflicts. And the only thing you have to do is go through those two signals on either side. It's a very efficient interchange in a very small footprint. The advantage of this is the right-of-way that we need to build this has very small impacts, and it operates very efficiently.
I'm missing something. So start back where you're going to go across, because if you go to the left, how do you take a right to go north without a conflict? Or do you take the right before you hit the...
Yeah, you take a right before you hit the signal.
Okay,
and then after
you.
The signal, you'll make your left.
Okay.
Yeah, and that'll happen both directions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then the same thing when you're in your off-ramps, you won't have, as you're coming off here, you'll make your right, and then you'll make your turn here. It'll also... Again, feel like a right turn, even though it's a left turn, because you won't have a conflict.
I got you.
So there's only those two signals that have two phases, one way, the other way, without all the multi-phase signals. It's a very simple signal operation and very efficient design in a small footprint.
Yeah.
Last project to talk about is Bly Mountain. This is another project that's been on our books for a long, long time. People in Klamath County and Lake County have wanted this project from a safety standpoint, and again, opening up truck traffic to the east in this area. This is this highway, like we were just talking about, Senator Girard and Highway 20, is an old highway designed back in the 20s and 30s, and carries major traffic in this part of the state. This is also a project where we pioneered a lot of our use of technology in construction. This is our first project where we have taken all the design through 3D design, taken it directly from the designer, and entered it into the equipment. And the operators out here are operating off of that 3D information from their consoles in their piece of equipment. And there's very little, almost no construction staking on this project at all. It's pretty amazing to watch these big pieces of machinery just go out in the middle of the woods and start building the road, and all of a sudden you see a road type take shape. It's pretty fascinating stuff. So in these pictures I'm showing you, you'll notice there's no stakes in any of these pictures, and a lot of heavy construction taking place. In this picture, just to illustrate that a little bit, this excavator right here in the center, you'll see the little antennas, or where they're taking in the information from GPS on this piece of equipment. He's the one that's actually doing the grade by design. This one here is just taking his material and loading the trucks, and this piece here has a jackhammer on the end, is just finishing up the piece of boulder that are sticking out of the design and kind of polishing the project off. And the three of those just kind of walk through the project. Again, it's pretty amazing to watch without any staking or anything in watching this project. Again, the project has gone very smoothly. It's ahead of schedule, under budget, a lot of efficiencies that we're seeing with this use of technology.
Do you have a sense, Paul, proportionally, how much that saves in the construction?
We're quantifying that in individual projects, Mr. Chair, but typically it's 5 or 6% in real construction. But time-wise, it can be 20 or 30% in time. For example, in Woodburn, we estimated that project was going to take 3 years. It took 2 years, and that's typical. What we'll see is a huge amount of time savings, but real cost savings as well. So just to give you a sense of what we've been up to over the last 10 years, as we bring GATA projects to a close, we finished the OTIA program during the last 10 years. We've delivered over 800 projects in ODOT, almost $4 billion worth of projects. If you add all those projects up, our good projects, our bad projects, whether it's Pioneer Mountain, whether it's some of the projects, the other ones I've talked about here today, we are 1% under budget when you roll all those together, and 85% of those have been opened up on time.
So when will we roll finish with JTA?
We have, Mr. Chair, we have let our last contract this last spring. It's the Tillamook project, and so it has a couple-year construction cycle on it. There's a Highway 62 project that, I don't know if you were on the tour when we were in Medford, those two will kind of race to be the last two through the process. So it's probably 2019 construction season will be wrapped up.
And do we have the same kind of information on the three OTAs?
The OTIA program.
Yeah.
Yes,
there
was something. Yep. All those projects have been completed.
So
yeah.
The state didn't necessarily do the local ones.
Good.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Any questions, Paul? Great report. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. So we're now going to move on to an update on the Real ID Act. This will be exciting. Sorry, guys. Mr. McClellan.
Good morning, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, today representing the DMV, and here with DMV Administrator Tom McClellan. We're here to give you an informational update about the Real ID Act. Submitted a written piece of testimony with some attachments that are pretty interesting, but just in summary, the Real ID Act of 2005 had to do with improving the security and reliability of states' driver licenses and ID cards. Those came in kind of 42 different requirements, primary requirements in three areas: the security of the physical card itself, the information supporting the issuance and the information on the card itself, and then the security of the physical facilities and the people doing the issuance, the DMV employees and contractors that do the issuance. The penalty to a state for failing to comply with Real ID is not monetary, which we usually see in the world of federal requirements on a Department of Transportation. Instead, the failure to comply results in that state's credentials not being acceptable for federal identification purposes. Homeland Security, about 3 years ago, issued a schedule of staged enforcement, and obviously we're more than 10 years since the passage of the Act. There were a number of deferrals, blanket deferrals over time. But the staged enforcement schedule came out. Currently, under that staged enforcement, several have been implemented. So to enter federal facilities like nuclear facilities, federal military bases, and some federal buildings, you need to present, if you're going to use a driver license or ID card, a credential from a state that is Real ID compliant or is under an extension. The big one that everybody's waiting for is, when are they going to enforce to board commercial flights with TSA? The first time that would be enforced for any state will be January 20th of 2018. So just again to reinforce, no state's IDs will be rejected by the TSA until at the earliest January of 2018. And then final enforcement October of 2020 to enter these federal facilities or board commercial aircraft. If you're going to use an ID card or a driver license, it needs to be marked as a compliant card. Oregon, as I think you all know, is not compliant with Real ID, but is currently under an extension, which expires October 10th of 2016. In 2009, the legislature passed Senate Bill 536, which effectively prohibited ODOT DMV from becoming Real ID compliant. We can't spend money unless federal funds are provided to cover the cost and some other privacy issues in that bill. And there was some grant money available from the feds, but nothing like enough to cover full enforcement. So over time, DMV has made small administrative changes that served a primary purpose, but it secondarily brought us a little bit closer to Real ID compliance. And through that, we've been able to garner extensions. We're on our third extension at this time, and again, that expires October 10th of this year. So that deadline is approaching, and we have some new information about going forward what we're looking at as a state.
Chair Byer, members of the committee, again, my name is Tom McClellan, DMV Administrator with the Department of Transportation. We have had some conversations with the officials with the Department of Homeland Security in the last few months, trying to get a sense of, you know, where are they going as far as standards, as far as approving further extensions for states. And what we have learned from them is that states that have laws on the books that prohibit compliance are not going to have much of a chance of getting many more extensions, let alone one this time around. That they're looking for states to make some commitments, as in removing those barriers and starting to make those changes to statutes that are necessary to comply in order to receive further extensions. With the time frames that Amy just explained to you, we have 16 months until the effective enforcement at airports. That's even if we were given authority now, which you can't change statutes, you know, when you're not in session, but if we were told immediately right now, we still couldn't be ready in that short period of time. So our best bet at this point is to get a further extension if the intent is to avoid that impact to Oregonians, the cards that they present. What we've found out from both written and verbal communications with the Homeland Security officials is that some signal of intent to make changes to statutes, intent to authorize resources to for the state to comply, would be sufficient to be granted another extension. It may not be a year's extension. It may be until, you know, that legislature session ends. So it might be a 9-month extension, not a 12-month extension, to see if those changes do actually take place.
So Tom, how many states are in the same position as Oregon?
Yeah, Chair Byer and members of the committee, I think the number is 23. It's roughly half, a little less than half, are not compliant but are under an extension. In your materials, there's a map of the U.S. that's color-coded in terms of who's compliant and who isn't.
And I assume you've had some discussion with your peers in those other 20-some states?
Yes.
What's their intent?
Chair Byer, it's mixed. Those that have the prohibitions, of course, are not doing anything really to comply. But a number of the larger states, Virginia and California, for example, I know have submitted compliance packages fully knowing that everything they do doesn't comply with the federal requirements. But there's some language in there about being materially compliant or having a suitable procedure that would otherwise meet the requirements or the intent behind those requirements. So there is some leeway there. And so what they've done in their compliance packages is identify something they do that may be similar or what they believe achieves the desired end of the federal regulation. And they're now waiting to see if Homeland Security will, in fact, accept their package and make them compliant. Just doing that may be enough for them to get another extension. So we're starting to see some of the larger states. I think New York has made a commitment to toward compliance. Texas, I've heard, has indicated they intend to comply. You start to get some of those larger states, and we become the minority if we are continue to be in the position we're in right now.
Senator?
The obvious cost, how much would it cost to be compliant?
Chair Byer, Senator Girard, it would depend on the approach we take. The two basic approaches that I've explained to a few people is that we could make Oregon's standard just regular card compliant, and all our procedures behind that would be a compliant card. That's going to be a more expensive route and a more onerous process for Oregonians to go through as far as presenting documentation that they've already presented to us, that they're in the country legally and who they are. But that would be a more costly approach. Another option would be to issue a second card that has an identifier. Most states are putting a star in the upper right corner of the card. And the person who possesses that card has gone through a slightly different approach and presented some of those documents again and been issued a different type of card. That approach is going to be less expensive, but still on the order of close to $1 million to implement, and probably a couple $1 million every biennium in the staffing. Because unless you want our wait times to go higher, which I doubt that you would want that, we would probably ask for some additional positions to take on that extra workload in our field offices.
Is that similar? Your second approach, is that similar to what Washington State did?
Similar but different. They issue an enhanced driver license that they created for crossing the border for the Olympics a few years ago. It has a chip embedded into it. We're not proposing anything like that with a chip. But they do have a card, an enhanced driver license, that Homeland Security has deemed compliant. But their standard card that they issue in Washington is not compliant, and they're one of those states you'll see on the map that has been deemed non-compliant, and their standard card is not accepted at those federal facilities that Amy mentioned.
You know, this is getting into philosophies. This is, if the Congress wanted to do this, they should have just issued a national ID card rather than screwing around with our license.
Isn't that called a passport?
Yeah. Yeah. It's actually not like Oregonians, if we don't comply, won't be able to get onto airplanes. They'll just have to get their passport.
Yes, that's true.
Which is a lot cheaper.
Which will...
It's an additional cost.
All of this stuff will...
less for a passport card than what it is for an Oregon driver's license.
Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting in 2018 how much additional work TSA is going to have to do at the airports to try and satisfy Congress and Senate.
Okay, in 2009, we passed legislation that said no and hell no. Basically, it said you shall not move toward compliance unless the feds pay for it.
Basically. Yes, that's true.
Now, the timeline on that is approaching in 2 weeks, October of this year.
Senator Monroe, it is October 10th is when the extension that we're under right now expires.
And to get another extension, we have to move toward changing that law that we passed in 2009, take a step in that direction or something?
Yeah, Chair Beyer and Senator Monroe, I mean, the one thing we have to do, and which ODOT DMV intends to do, is submit a request for extension, and we can indicate, you know, how secure our cards are and all that kind of stuff. But the indication we received from Homeland Security was, you should really include in that request an indication from officials who can change the law that in 2017 you'll at least, you know, take a run at, you know, at
so
lifting that prohibition.
If this committee introduced legislation toward that end for the 2017 session, which we can do, would that be
cold day in hell?
You have a chair that doesn't want that.
Well, I'm just trying to say, what do we need to do? You know, I voted for the measure in 2009, and I think that if the feds, you know, want ID compliance, they ought to pay for it. But at this point, our good citizens of Oregon that don't have passports and that can't get on a plane are going to be a little upset.
Be even more interesting, Senator, when they try to impanel federal juries in Oregon and they find they can't.
Okay.
True.
Anybody else? Anything else you would like to tell us about this today?
Oh, I know.
I suspect that you'll be trying to introduce legislation.
Chair Beyer, actually, no, that is not bringing forward a concept for real ID compliance.
Oh,
we are providing information for the legislature because at this point it's going to take legislative action, and the policy of the state of Oregon is clear on the books right now. And
yep.
Thank you.
So,
any more?
Chair Beyer, I will just add, it does appear that the Ways and Means Committee will be directing our agency to do further analysis, bring a report back in the next few months. So you used to have, you have a bit more solid information to work from a policy decision.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Patrick.
Mr. Chair, next up we're going to have a briefing on the Volkswagen settlement. We have Richard Whitman, Paul Garahan, and Kevin Downing. It'll be our panel for that. And they're going to have a slide presentation as well.
Okay, good.
Am I being totally unreasonable?
We seem to have lost a lot of folks.
Far left and far right, we'll love you. It's one of those two meet in the middle. I kind of think you need to be compliant.
Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Richard Whitman. I'm the director of Governor Brown's Natural Resources Office. We're here today to give the committee a short briefing on a very important settlement that was reached a couple months ago. And I'm not going to do a lot of talking here. I'm going to let the experts do the talking. But I do want to say a couple words at the outset. This represents a significant violation of our air quality laws by Volkswagen. And the installation of defeat devices in diesel vehicles by Volkswagen has resulted in significant harm to our public in terms of diesel emissions. And you're going to hear about the details of the settlement today. But one aspect of that is trying to rectify some of that damage to public health. And we are going to be working with stakeholders and the legislature going forward to determine exactly how to use that part of the settlement. But I do want to stress that this was a significant violation. It's a significant settlement. And I want to thank, and the governor wants to thank, Attorney General Rosenbaum and also Mr. Garahan here for their role in working on the settlement with Volkswagen. Oregon was very active in the settlement discussions and continues to be so. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Garahan.
Thank you. Paul Garahan. I'm the attorney in charge of the Natural Resources section at the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm also the contact counsel for DEQ on air quality matters. So the Volkswagen settlement decree, I will begin by saying it's a proposed settlement that the parties have agreed to. It's under review at this time. It arose out of claims and negotiations with the primary parties being EPA, the U.S. Department of Justice, the Federal Trade Commission, consumer class action plaintiffs, and also not listed there but actively involved was the California Air Resources Board. The consumer class action cases that were filed all around the country were either filed in federal court or removed to federal court, and then they were all transferred into a multi-district litigation in the U.S. District Court in San Francisco. So they're all in front of one judge who oversaw settlement negotiations between those primary parties. So those primary issues and the emission requirements that were violated were federal requirements and then also primarily requirements that were adopted by California. California is permitted under the Clean Air Act to adopt its own emission standards, and then other states are permitted to follow suit and adopt California's identical standards if they choose to do so. And Oregon is one of the states that has adopted California's emission standards here. So that's why California and the California Air Resources Board, which has been a leader in developing emission standards like this, played such a prominent role with the EPA. So negotiations occurred, and a proposed settlement has been reached. I'll walk through some of the details there. The role that we played is that there are state claims involved here. There were consumer protection claims. There are environmental violations. And part of this proposed settlement that I'll get to involves a mitigation fund to be administered by the states. And so there was participation by state entities, state attorneys general offices, in helping to provide information related to how that element of the settlement would be structured. The settlement involves right now only the Volkswagen and Audi 2-liter diesel engines, which amounts to approximately 475,000 vehicles nationwide. It does not address similar issues with defeat devices, different type of defeat device in some of the Volkswagen, Audi, and Porsche 3-liter engines. There are about 85,000 vehicles there, and their negotiations continue related to those vehicles. The vehicles were in question were all manufactured with emission defeat devices, and they were model year vehicles 2009 through 2015. The proposed settlement decree and the court will have an approval hearing on October 18th, so we expect for the settlement. The U.S. Department of Justice has taken comments on the proposed settlement. We don't know what their final recommendation to the court will be in response to those comments, but there'll be a hearing on October 18th, so we anticipate that the settlement will be approved at some point, either on the 18th or thereafter. There are three primary elements of the settlement. There are the consumer options, and consumers can find out more information. Owners or lessees of these vehicles can find out more information by going to the website vwcourtsettlement.com, and that has information on how folks, as this settlement becomes finalized, how they can start to take advantage of the remedies that it includes. So there are the consumer options. There's a zero-emission vehicle investment plan, commitment by VW to invest $2 billion in zero-emission vehicle programs. And there's an environmental mitigation fund designed to remedy all of the harm caused by the excess emissions, primarily excess NOx emissions. And that fund is $2.7 billion nationwide. Looking at each of these options, elements of the proposed settlement, the consumer options, and I'll highlight that the options for consumers are not mandatory. Consumers can choose what they'd like to do. They're still working EPA, the California Air Resources Board, CARB, and Volkswagen are still working on the final elements of whether there will be a repair option, whether there will be a satisfactory fix to the vehicles to reduce their emissions. So assuming that that gets approved, and it was made part of this because they thought they were close and would be able to approve it, but it hasn't been finally approved yet. If that gets approved, consumers will have an option either for their cars to be bought back at their Blue Book value on the day before this scandal became public about a year ago, or to repair their vehicles. And so that repair would be at VW's cost. In addition, under either option, owners will get a minimum restitution payment between $5,000 and about $10,000 per vehicle, depending on the age of the vehicle. Lessees will get comparable options. They'll be able to terminate their lease with no penalty. They'll get a cash restitution payment. It's approximately half of what the owners of the vehicles might get. While the consumers are not required to participate, so if a consumer chooses, they may continue to drive the vehicle as is. But if VW is not successful in reaching an 85% implementation level of the vehicles, either buying them back and scrapping them or implementing the fix for owners by June 30th of 2019, then VW is responsible to pay more money into the mitigation fund, both the state mitigation fund and a California element of the mitigation fund. The mitigation fund is designed to completely mitigate for all of the excess emissions that were caused, including if 15% of the vehicles are not fixed and continue to emit. The mitigation fund was designed and intended to be large enough to reduce other emissions enough to offset all of those other emissions. The second element of the proposed settlement is a zero-emission vehicle investment, where VW commits to a $2 billion investment. $800 million of that will be spent in California under the proposed settlement, and the other $1.2 billion in the rest of the country. It'll be under a plan developed and managed by VW and approved and monitored by EPA and by CARB. It will include brand neutral education. It may include brand neutral education and public outreach. It may include programs to increase familiarity with zero emission vehicles, car and ride sharing programs, and it may involve installation of public charging or hydrogen fueling infrastructure, zero emission vehicle infrastructure. Finally, on the mitigation fund, it's $2.7 billion total allocated per vehicle registration. So because it's intended to offset the excess emissions, it's based on how many vehicles are located in each state. It's designed to be state administered. It will be a trust fund will be established. It's not a federal administered program. It'll be administered by a trustee. There are guidelines on how states will qualify, certifications that they'll need to make. Oregon's share of that will be a little more than $68 million. VW is paying into this fund over 3 years, $900 million per year. So not all the funds would be immediately available in the first year. The funds are limited to eligible actions described in the proposed settlement that are targeted at reducing the prior and the ongoing excess emissions, to reduce those NOx emissions from motor vehicles. In order to participate, there are a couple of the key things states need to do. States would need to waive their right to injunctive relief resulting from the violations. In other words, relief based on the harm caused, because this mitigation fund is designed to offset and mitigate the harm that was caused by these excess emissions. And states also must adopt necessary implementing legislation within 2 years of submitting their certification form to participate in the program. An element of that will be a legislative proposal that will be brought forward in this legislative session, I believe, to modify the Oregon air quality statutes to put them in line and be ready to be able to participate in the mitigation fund. So that's a basic description of that. And now, in terms of how that program and mitigation fund might be put together, I'll turn things over to my colleague, Kevin Downing.
Good morning. My name is Kevin Downing. I'm with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. And so, as Mr. Whitman had mentioned, this was really about an emissions issue involving impacts on public health. Diesel engines are used widely because of their power, durability, reliability, and economy. And but for that exhaust element, there's some concerns there. So there's a complex mixture of gases and particles emitted by diesel engines that have impacts on a variety of health effects among people. One of those, most prominently, is that it's been listed as a known human carcinogen by the International Association for Research on Cancer, but it also impacts, as you can see on the slide, on both not only the respiratory system, but cardiovascular as well as neural system as well. As Paul had mentioned, the Environmental Mitigation Fund requires certain steps for the state to take. One of those is the governor has to file a certification letter designated a state agency to receive and manage the funds. As Paul had mentioned, we will be looking for modifications to the statute to allow us to accept the state to accept these funds, but the department will also be seeking budgetary authority to accept the funds as well, as including a policy option package for positions to actually administer the program as well. And the last bullet is up just to because this is not a federal program, the states are accepting these funds will notify federal agencies that themselves have diesel engines, the availability of the fund, they may choose to apply for to the state for expenditures from the fund. The state must submit a mitigation plan. This is meant to be high level to the trustee that has will describe the types of activities to be supported, the goals to be met, what consideration for relief to disproportionately impacted populations are accounted for within the plan, as well as an estimate of the range of emission benefits to be realized. The court has been fairly prescriptive in outlining what they consider to be eligible expenditures for the activities, and this is just an example of one. There's actually seven categories, so I'll go into that a little bit more, but for instance, they will look for category medium and heavy-duty trucks, buses, transit buses, school buses, and shuttle buses. And for non-government-owned vehicles, the court allows for 40% for engine repowering. And a repower basically is where you take an old engine out of the vehicle and replace it with a newer, lower-emitting engine. In this case, it could be diesel, but it could also be natural gas or propane or electricity, for that matter. 25%, so that's repowering, so 25% towards the purchase of a new vehicle, providing the old vehicle is scrapped. If it's a dray truck, and a dray truck is a truck with a preponderance of trips into and out of a port or other intermodal facility, so 50% for a dray truck. And for an electric repower or actually electric vehicle replacement, 75% towards the cost of that. These are for non-government-owned vehicles. For government-owned vehicles, the court will allow 100% of eligible costs to be covered by awards from the fund. Same kind of breakdown in terms of eligible activities. And the same kind of pattern we'll see through the rest of the categories as well. The court also acknowledges switcher locomotives, ferries and tugs, airport ground support equipment, cargo handling forklifts are all other classes of activity, classes of equipment that the court considers appropriate for expending funds. And again, same kind of differential between a lower percentage for privately owned vehicles and a higher percentage, 100% for government-owned vehicles. For most of these, for ferries and airport ground support equipment, cargo handling forklifts, the only option really is for repowering. For the locomotives, the court considers replacement and or engine repowering an eligible project activity. The court has also outlined allowable expenditures for ocean vessel shore power. So this is the dockside provision of electricity that would allow a ship to plug in while it's at dock so they can turn off their engines while loading and unloading cargo. This reduces emissions, but also requires changes to the vessels themselves. That's not covered by the fund. The court also allows, in this case, up to 15% of the funds to be used to for zero-emission vehicle infrastructure, either charging stations for electric or for hydrogen fuel stations for fuel cell vehicles. This is the timeline. That we see outlined within the court's decree for the next steps to be taken. So the highlight, so the green box is meant to, shows up as green, great, is meant to highlight what the trustee is required to do. The trustee, as Paul had mentioned, the court will likely approve this by late October. They still need to hire a trustee, which the anticipation is that may be by sometime around January or so. At which point, then there's a trust effective date, which drives timing for everything else under the decree. Within 60 days of the trust effective date, the governors of every state, as well as District of Columbia and I think Puerto Rico, I'm not sure there's any other territories involved, must send a letter to the trustee outlining various certifications, some of which we described to you earlier, saying that we want to participate in the program and we assert that we can meet the conditions of the decree. Those will be accepted by the trustee, and then whether either the United States or the trustee themselves determines that there's another period of time in which they will evaluate those certifications. If they find that there's an issue, that can be challenged, and so within that next 120 days from the trust effective date is when that challenge and review period occurs. By 120 days out, the trustee will publish a list of certified beneficiaries. And if you're not on that list, then you're out of the program altogether. There's a pending listing for beneficiaries as well, assuming that there's some issues, as Paul suggested, that need to be resolved. But if you're on path towards doing that, you can be on this pending list. Within 120 days out is when that beneficiary list is published. And then within 30 days of that publication of that list, the states must respond with the mitigation plan. So the mitigation plan, as I say, is a high-level plan to describe to the court and the trustee exactly what the intentions are for how the money is to be expended. You can see on the sort of light brown category are what we see are actions by DEQ. We are within the prescription for how money is to be spent. There's certainly opportunity to talk about priorities, about which categories should be focused on and how the conditions will be applied to determine what becomes an eligible a preferred eligible project as opposed to one that's actually, many of these projects are all good inherently, but there's with a limited amount of money, you have to make a choice about sort of where you choose to spend the money. We are starting with, we have a web page up now. We're building a mailing list. We've invited people that have been tracking diesel and transportation issues. We have a webinar set up for next Tuesday afternoon in which we'll go over the terms of the decree, much like what we're doing here, but more detail, so that people understand what's involved with that. We intend to engage with stakeholders in a process over the fall and to engage in a robust conversation about what would be the appropriate elements to include within the mitigation plan and what priorities to provide for that. You can see that there's an overlap with the legislative session. There'll probably be, certainly there'll be conversations within this body and with the department around those priorities as well. And then we have actually, as Paul had mentioned, up to 2 years finally to submit a final certification that we're in place and we're able to accept the money, and in which case then we proceed going forward with the plan. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Will the plan itself require legislative approval?
No.
Senator?
Yeah, my question is if and when we receive Volkswagen settlement money, will that money be considered part of the highway fund and restricted as the highway fund is, or will we have the ability to use it for other transportation needs?
Chair Beyer, Senator Monroe, the money does not just come into the state and then can be spent and budgeted as other money is. The money stays in the trust fund. The state has to develop a plan about that complies with the requirements in the proposed settlement about how it's going to spend those monies consistent in those specific categories. It then goes out to seek projects. When it has a project that is complies, then it may request that money from the trust fund, and it's required to spend that money only on that specific project consistent with the trust fund. So there's not unfettered discretion here on spending the money on any project, and the money actually doesn't necessarily even have to come into state control. It could be directed directly to a source that's into another agency that's implementing a program, although there has to be oversight to ensure the money is spent consistent with the trust.
But that plan could include things like rail, enhancing our high-speed rail in the corridor, or transit, purchasing transit vehicles, or whatever.
Chair Beyer, Senator Monroe, it is not open-ended like that. It's only for those targeted on those specific categories that Mr. Downing walked through that are focused on replacing, old diesel engines in certain types of vehicles and equipment right now with alternative fuel or cleaner, newer diesel engines.
But we would not have the kind of restrictions that we have in the Constitution on use of the highway fund.
That's correct. Okay. Chair Beyer, Senator Monroe, that's correct. There are not restrictions because this is not money that's revenue coming in that would have to comply with those restrictions.
Senator Durrett?
Yeah, first of all, I need to declare a potential conflict as my wife has a car that's going to be recalled. So I think that's important to put on the record. I have to tell you that because of that, and we have followed this extremely close, that I don't think the consumer is coming out of this thing
very well at all, and the state is out there trying to get as much money as they possibly can. And you look at the how much money the state's getting $28 million out of this deal, and I just really feel very strongly that the person that bought the darn car, which you're between a rock and a hard place. That car has a stigma to it that you're never going to, I just don't think you're going to be able to sell it in the open market if you want it to. So you're going to have to get rid of it. And the state isn't looking out for the consumer. The state's looking out for their own darn derriere. And that really bothers me. I doubt very much if you could take air samples now versus air samples with what you want, that you could actually say there's a difference in the air samples. I think it's just simply the state wants the money, and really you took it out of the hands of the consumer. So that's all I want to say.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, just in closing here, as you've heard, there are some significant constraints on the use of this money, but there are some policy decisions that will need to be made by the legislature and working together with the executive branch. Speaking for Governor Brown, I think she is particularly interested in assuring that that portion of the settlement that is coming to the state be used to as much as we can offset the health effects. And, you know, overall, the program is designed to fully offset the health effects. One bug I'm going to plant with you all that jumps right out when one thinks about how to help vulnerable populations is our school buses, our older school buses who are, transporting children that are a particularly vulnerable population in terms of potential health effects of diesel emissions. So we are looking at change out or replacement of older school buses as being at least a component of this plan. But as Mr. Downing said, we're just entering the public engagement phase of this. We'll be taking input from the public generally. Obviously, there's a lot of discussion to be had with this body as well. Thank you.
Well, I would, I guess I have a question. One of the things when I first heard of this that I did do, and I think DEQ's got it, is ask DMV where the vehicles are. And they were able to provide me a list of the numbers by county of where they are. So I would assume that one of the things we would do is if you're trying to mitigate the harm, you would focus the money on where the majority of those vehicles are. No, so I think you want to look at that. The other thing, Richard, I guess I would, it always sounds nice when you start talking about school buses and things like that, and it seems to me one of the things you ought to think about is how long those buses are going to run. That's great, but the thing, you know, we always focus on that, but school buses only run a couple hours a day. If you were to compare that to, for example, the TriMet buses or the Chariot buses here, those are running on the streets all day long and probably have a greater impact on that. So I think you want to look at that. The other thing, and we've had some of this experiment with looking at trucks and some of that, and I know there's some interest in changing those things out in the area, but I think we want to make sure to the extent we can that if we spend this limited money in Oregon, that we spend it on things that are likely to stay here.
Yes.
And not go out of state and be sold to somebody else. So just a couple of comments.
Good points. Thank you.
Anything else, committee? Well, good luck with that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm sure this is not the last time we'll hear about this.
Oh, yeah.
All righty, Patrick, we're up to foreign investment, I think.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Evan Hoffman and Matthew Miller are here to talk about foreign direct investment. And they have a slide presentation as well, Mr. Chair.
We're moving right along. We're making good progress this morning. Mm-hmm. Actually, with the restitution.
She is 13 grand. Mm-hmm. 13 grand for 3 years worth of
pay. But that's on top of the kit. You get to keep the car.
Yeah.
You sure?
Yeah.
I thought it was restitution was on top of having the car fixed or something else.
No, you can't think there's no fix.
They have to buy the car, if you want to sell it, they have to buy the car back at what it was worth just before this settlement was reached.
And you get no less.
Not quite that way.
She's going to get 13,000.
It's not.
Welcome.
And the state is not, the state's looking out for the state. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Good morning, Chairman Beyer and members of the committee. Thanks for having me today. My name is Evan Hoffman. I'm the Senior Manager for State Government Affairs for the Organization for International Investment. We're here to talk about my favorite topic, foreign direct investment, FDI. So I will cover kind of where the United States stands globally and talk a little bit about a few policies that will help attract foreign direct investment into the state of Oregon. And then Matt will cover a little bit more specifics about the state itself. So what is my organization, AFI? We are a trade association that represents 175 U.S. subsidiaries of globally headquartered companies that choose to invest in the United States. And I think the Committee A just handed out our membership list, so you can take a look at who our member companies are. Our members come from all industry sectors, from countries all around the world, but they share one thing in common, and that is they choose to locate operations and investment into the United States and create U.S. jobs while doing so. So our mission as an organization is simple. We work to create a policy environment at the federal and state level which will be competitive and attractive to recruiting foreign direct investment. And once these firms locate here, we work on policies to ensure that they are treated just like any other investor, that their U.S. employees and firms are treated with non-discrimination. So why is this important for Oregon? Foreign direct investment is an extremely powerful economic narrative for the United States. When these firms invest in the United States, they tend to locate high-value economic activities into our regions. A lot of manufacturing, a lot of innovation. All told, these companies employ 6.1 million U.S. workers directly. And to think about it this way, it's about 5% of the private sector workforce overall. And there's a lot of added benefits beyond the jobs that come when you attract foreign direct investment. These companies pay higher wages on average, and that's because they're locating a lot of high-value economic activities here. In addition, they tend to be very charitable in their communities, so there's a lot of added benefit beyond the jobs when you recruit foreign direct investment. I often ask the question to policymakers, what percentage of the U.S. workforce is in manufacturing? You know, it's a key buzzword in Washington, for example. And they'll say maybe 10%, maybe 25%. One of the best benefits of attracting foreign direct investment is that it is most concentrated in manufacturing. Almost 40% of all FDI jobs are manufacturing jobs. So when folks are talking about a resurgence of American manufacturing and what can we do to attract more manufacturing, we always come back and say, well, foreign direct investment strategy should be part of your overall strategy. In addition, global companies in America fund 16% of all U.S. research and development funding. And when you think about it, this really makes sense. Why would global companies locate innovation to the United States? Well, America has the best university network, the best laboratories, world-class engineers, world-class scientists, strong rule of law, strong IP protection. So all the ingredients you need to be successful in R&D, America has. And a clear example of this, and Matt knows this story, is Jaguar Land Rover in Portland. A few years ago, they opened up a research center and an incubator, and they were working with startups to fund innovative automotive technologies. It's been really successful. And a few months ago, they announced an expansion opportunity, and they plan on bringing 30 more engineers on site at that location in Portland. And one more thing I'll talk about in terms of added economic value, U.S. exports. Almost a quarter of all U.S. exports sent overseas are produced by global companies in the United States. So foreign-based businesses view the U.S. as an export platform. So a lot of their investment is heavily concentrated here as well. So where does America stand globally? In 2015 was the best year in the history of America for attracting foreign direct investment. We brought in $350 billion worth of investment. Just think about that for a moment and where that money and how it flows throughout the communities once it's invested here. The U.S. remains the world's number one attractor of foreign direct investment. That shouldn't come as a surprise to folks. We've attracted about $3.1 trillion in investment over time. But I do want to call your attention to this white line that cuts across the graph here. So that is the percentage of foreign direct investment the United States attracts compared to the world. If you could extend this graph back to 2000, the white line would have been 37%. So in 2000, America attracted 37% of all foreign direct investment flows. That's fallen to 22% today. And so that's a concerning trend that my organization is looking to reverse, and that's some of the policy work we do. So where does investment flow from? Most folks are surprised to hear that 8 countries account for 75% of all foreign direct investment into the United States. So these are the top 5 investors into the United States. In Oregon, the UK, Germany, and Japan are the top 3 provider of FDI jobs. The other 3 countries not on this list include Switzerland, the Netherlands, and Ireland. So AFI, we have many member companies based in Oregon. I just wanted to give you a quick flavor. Daimler in Portland. You've got Genentech in Hillsboro. Senator Riley, I think that's a constituent company of yours. Garmin in Salem, they have a major center here. Iberdrola, they produce wind energy, and they have a huge facility in Sherman County. Thomson Reuters in Lake Oswego. Siemens has several sites throughout the state. So all told, in Oregon, you've got 600 global companies that have chosen to locate here, and they provide about 50,000 jobs for Oregons directly. So if you look into these charts here, we dig a little bit deeper into where Oregon stands compared to the rest of the United States. I want to just call your attention to that graph on the right with the red arrow. You can see that foreign direct investment job numbers have grown by 5.3%, which is outperforming the private sector average overall. I just will say one thing. This data is outdated by 3 years, and so I know there's been a lot of job attraction into Oregon in recent years, so I'm curious to see what these numbers will look like a couple years from now, because government data is outdated a little bit. Okay, so we love to tell the foreign direct investment narrative across different ways. We wanted to take a look at, besides the direct jobs that global companies bring into the United States, what are the other economic impacts? So we wanted to look at the supply chain impacts, because so much FDI is concentrated in manufacturing, and then also those induced jobs impacts. So once these employees spend their paychecks in the community, how many waiters and dry cleaning technicians also have their jobs because of foreign direct investment? So we launched this study this year, and that's the total amount of jobs supported by foreign direct investment in Oregon, 201,000. So that's a great, powerful economic narrative. So I want to talk a little bit more specifically about some policies that lead to more foreign direct investment attraction. Every 2 years, we poll our chief financial officers about how the U.S. investment climate compares to the rest of the world. These executives are important because they're key decision makers in the allocation of capital for their companies. And so it's really interesting data for us. This chart here shows that their confidence in the U.S. business climate is actually declining for the next 12 months. But that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it shows there's areas of improvement that we could be making. Then we asked our CFOs, okay, so once a company chooses to locate to the United States, why would they choose Oregon versus Iowa or California versus Arizona? What drives investment to a particular region? The top 3 things, according to our CFOs, are number 1, proximity to customers and access to a market that shouldn't surprise people. Number 2 is having that skilled workforce. And number 3, economic incentives do play some kind of role in their decision process. And then this is a crowded slide, but really important for state and local governments. We asked, once a firm locates in a state, what services can state and local governments provide that will create an even more attractive business environment that will allow these companies to further succeed? And the red bars show those services that are either very important or somewhat important to the company. And so you can see the top 3 services that state and local governments can provide are maintaining high-quality infrastructure and the facilitation of any permitting issues, license questions, and other regulatory issues. And then number 3, ensuring non-discrimination. So what that means is if you're a global company and you're investing in the United States, you shouldn't be treated differently just because you have global heritage. We do a lot of work as an organization with governor's offices across the United States and economic development organizations on helping folks understand the best types of foreign direct investment strategies. These are a few of the things that we work a lot on. I know Matt will go into the specifics about a lot of these for the state of Oregon, but I do want to draw your attention real quickly to that last bullet, which is really a fundamental pillar of AFI, which is ensuring non-discrimination in policy and regulation.
So what is your term, what does aftercare mean?
Sure. So aftercare, 77% of jobs that foreign direct investors create in the United States are from your existing investor base. So these companies are already here in the United States, and they choose to expand. So aftercare is creating an environment that is competitive for these companies to continue to expand and achieve here. So it's about working closely with the companies, understanding their needs and issues as they go through the life cycle of their investment. It's about integrating them into your community, interacting frequently with their executives. There's a lot that goes into it, but it's about helping these companies expand. And that's a key place where state and local government plays a role. You know, that facilitation of permitting and licenses, that's all aftercare. Maintaining infrastructure, that's all aftercare. But from AFI's perspective, ensuring non-discrimination is also really critical. And I'll close because of a really important issue that our member companies currently face in Oregon. I just want to flag it for you guys as an FYI. Our CFOs, this is a staff from our CFO survey, 4 in 10 experience some kind of unfair tax treatment. We track where there is discrimination in tax policy against global companies in the United States. So this is our heat map. It tracks where there have been issues either through legislation or currently in statute since 2014. And I do just want to draw your attention to Oregon, which we have highlighted here. There's one policy in Oregon that according to our member companies, is a significant barrier to increased foreign direct investment attraction. And many of you guys may be familiar about this because it drew a lot of attention during the last legislative session when there was an attempt to add Switzerland and the Netherlands to the state's list of jurisdictions that are considered tax havens. And this policy was enacted in 2013 as a way for the state to counter tax evasion, as a way for the state to protect its tax base. Very admirable goals, and the state has the right to pursue those goals. AFI would argue that there are lots of other policy choices the state could move in terms of adopting new policies that would achieve those same goals, but which don't carry the same consequences, the same unintended consequences, I should say, that the tax haven policy has on foreign direct investment. And I'll just give you a quick example. Let's pretend that tomorrow a company emerges in the Cayman Islands, which is one of the countries that is listed as a tax haven on this list. That company grows and is successful and suddenly wants to emerge and invest in the United States as a way to expand its business and reach new customers. The company is going to locate a manufacturing center, a distribution warehouse, an R&D center in order to achieve those goals in the United States. Because the company is on the list, it is automatically treated like that tax evader which the state is trying to go after. The list does not discriminate against legitimate business activity and those bad actors, and so that's where the challenge lies. The moment that company chooses to invest in Oregon, they're going to be subject to that same punitive taxation.
How did we get on this list? I'm sure. Missing something. Was that done by statute, or was that just done by our policies? I'm looking on here. California is not on the list.
So I can answer that question. I'm on the Revenue Committee as well, and that's where that statute came through. We spent a long time in the Revenue Committee looking at the countries that actually have these policies that are tax havens. It's not a secret that many countries are tax havens and are causing us to lose a lot of tax money because of it. And this policy is to make sure that we are able to actually protect our tax base. So it came through the Revenue Committee and it went through the floor and you voted on it.
I voted on it.
Yep.
Did I vote for it?
I don't know.
So that was the goal of the policy, and it's an approach that works from that standpoint, but it also carries these unintended consequences of impacting those legitimate companies that operate in these jurisdictions without tax evasion motivations from investing in the state potentially. And there are other approaches to achieve the same policy result that states like Connecticut and D.C. have recently adopted, along with others, that would achieve that same policy goal.
There in that same legislation are portions that exempt those companies that apparently do not use the tax evasion policies. We have that in our legislation. And may I, Mr. Chair, one other thing while I'm on my soapbox here. I looked at your member list, and there are many, many U.S. companies that have moved out of the U.S., and have become global companies that are headquartered somewhere other than the United States. Is that true?
Yeah, every one of the companies on that list is a U.S. subsidiary of a foreign-based company, so they do have they all have a global headquarters outside of America, correct? But they have all chosen to invest in the United States as well.
They're all U.S. companies, so I would assume they would, yes.
I can see where this could be viewed as a negative by some. But the other hand, to the extent that they're, as you said, most of them are manufacturing companies. One of the positives in Oregon's tax policy from a manufacturing perspective is their income only is taxed on their sales in the state. So if they're exporting companies, they essentially are not paying taxes on that at all.
Yeah, and I would say that.
Except for 97. Hmm? Measure 97.
Same deal.
Right. There are a lot of attractive reasons why global companies have selected Oregon to create jobs and invest here. And that speaks to that number where you've seen a significant percentage of job growth in this area over the last 5 years. I just call this out as just one area in policy that could be improved to even make Oregon a more attractive place for these businesses.
Go ahead.
Well, thank you guys for the time.
Oh, is that it?
Yes, from my presentation, yes.
Okay.
Good morning. My name is Matt Miller. I am Vice President of Business Development at Greater Portland, Inc. We are a regional economic development nonprofit serving the Portland metropolitan area. That's 7 counties, 2 in southwest Washington and 5 in Oregon. That includes Columbia, Multnomah, Washington, Clackamas, and Yamhill County. We market the region to domestic and international companies interested in expanding their operations, assisting them with market research and due diligence to evaluate the greater Portland region, and connect them and integrate them with workforce development, education institutions, the local industry base, and others. Our focus is on traded sector industry. Those are our 6 cluster areas that we think we have a true competitive advantage in the greater Portland region, including computer and electronics, software and IT services, the athletic and outdoor industry, health sciences and technology, clean technology, and metals and machinery manufacturing. About a year ago, Greater Portland, Inc. launched the Greater Portland Global Trade Investment Plan jointly with the Portland Development Commission, and advisory committees informed that plan's development, and they were comprised of partners from around the Greater Portland region. The plan, a project of the Brookings Institution and J.P. Morgan Chase Global Cities Initiative, aims to elevate our region's ability to attract global foreign direct investment and enhance our trade. So what is foreign direct investment? Foreign direct investment occurs when a foreign company invests in the United States in a U.S. business enterprise either by opening a new operation or through a merger or acquisition of an existing business. A foreign company must hold a majority stake in the U.S. operation for it to be considered foreign-owned. Why does it matter? FDI matters because U.S. operations of foreign firms contribute inordinately to the economy. While accounting for only 5% of private sector investment, private sector employment, FDI accounts for 3 times that much in capital investment, corporate research and development expenditures, and 4 times that for goods exported. FDI facilitates the spread of new knowledge, technology, and ideas, flows critical to innovation and competitiveness in the global economy. In Greater Portland is the 23rd largest metropolitan economy in the United States. We're 29th in foreign direct investment employment. We have over 41,000 jobs in the Greater Portland region that are controlled by foreign-owned establishments. FDI is overwhelmingly concentrated in our region in manufacturing, specifically motor vehicle manufacturing and computer and electronics manufacturing. Our top countries for foreign direct investment in Greater Portland are Germany, Japan, Switzerland, England, Canada. How do we go about attracting foreign direct investment? Our organization proactively recruits into foreign markets by going out and talking to these folks. So we have sales missions both domestic and internationally. We meet with companies and consultants that help companies evaluate global markets for expansion. Domestically, when we're going into San Francisco or New York or other markets, we're meeting with foreign direct investment arms of governments and consulates. Great example is the German-American Chamber in San Francisco. Obviously, we're marketing, we're leveraging a variety of media resources to market the value proposition for expanding in Greater Portland. We also leverage the U.S. federal government through their Select USA program, which is a program designed to focus solely on attracting foreign direct investment to the United States. Our organization joined the Port of Portland and Business Oregon's Japan Representative Office in Japan for meetings over 3 days in four different markets, talking about the value add of doing business in Greater Portland to over 250 prospective investors. We critically leverage Business Oregon's recruitment team and their foreign direct investment offices. Despite being the 23rd largest metropolitan economy in the United States and 29th in overall employment, we're 50th in FDI employment intensity, so we believe we can perform better. Comparatively speaking, we're the fifth fastest growing export metropolitan region in the United States among the largest 100 metropolitan areas, 13th by export volume. So we do a very great job at exporting products, but we have the opportunity to be attracting business into the market. Our trade investment plan has four general objectives. We want to create strong local and export and FDI cultures to build a reputation that Greater Portland is competitive for international business. We want to grow exports and FDI by aligning and coordinating regional economic development efforts around key industries and markets. We want to diversify our export industries, increasing the number of companies exporting to markets and the markets they access. And we want to build on foreign direct investment from leading source countries and industries while also seeking to grow FDI from underrepresented sources. Some of the strategies and tactics that we have and our plan is located on our website. This is the Greater Portland Global Trade Investment Plan. I can certainly provide information to access this document. We want to have stage of growth and industry-specific strategies. So an established industry like a semiconductor industry, we have different strategies, and we should tailor our strategies for that type of industry and those opportunities versus, say, software or emerging industry. We want to fine-tune our retention and expansion work locally. This is some of what Evan was mentioning in terms of aftercare. How can we be more proactive and engage more thoroughly the existing industry base, both non-FDI companies and also and FDI companies to either export or invest more in our region. And we have recently finished prioritizing our markets, so we have the highest ROI for our activities in terms of what countries we want to focus on. So our top three right now are Japan, Germany, and Canada. There are many other tactics in this plan, we want to urge you guys to take a look at that. I think it would be very informative. A case study that has been a shining example of the coordination between Business Oregon, the Japan Representative Office in Tokyo, as well as state and local partners is the expansion of Shimadzu in Canby, Oregon. Shimadzu USA Manufacturing is a division of Shimadzu Corporation, which is located in Kyoto, Japan. They manufacture analytical instruments for pharmaceutical and high-tech industries. In 1998, they relocated from the East Coast to the West Coast to improve their connectivity with Japan parent company and expansion access to global markets in East Asia. The company has grown to more than 100 employees in Canby. Other examples include the semiconductor supply chain in Hillsboro, including SolarWorld as well, Subaru in Gresham, Ajinomoto and Daimler and Adidas in Portland, Kyocera in Vancouver, Washington, Jaguar Land Rover in Portland, and countless other examples. I'd like to close by saying that there are a number of policy actions that are tied to this plan that, if undertaken, we believe would strengthen our ability to attract trade investment. One of which, and one I wanted to highlight this morning, is that Business Oregon has been an invaluable partner We would love to see maintained support and enhanced resources to Business Oregon and their international recruitment team, especially the representative offices in Tokyo and elsewhere. Without these folks, it would be very difficult to attract investment into Greater Portland and Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Seeing none, appreciate your coming down today.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Yes.
Next up, Mr. Eisdorfer. We're going to talk about storage, energy storage.
Yeah, so we're 8 to 11, and so we have about an hour and a half left. So
if we're cool.
So, yeah, we're definitely ahead of the curve.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. I'm Jason Eisdorfer, Program Director at the Public Utility Commission, and I was invited to give a short update on how the Public Utility Commission is implementing House Bill 2193 from 2015, which directs the commission to investigate the costs and benefits of energy storage and ultimately to oversee energy storage development proposals from Portland General Electric and PacifiCorp. Energy storage has been called the holy grail of the electricity system for most of the history of the electricity system. Electricity has not been, storage has not been an option. With developing technology, with increasing variable energy resources on the system, with increasing complexity, energy storage is now something that is of great interest to the regulator and the utility. So in next couple of slides, I'll have a slide on the refreshing our recollection on what 2193 did, a slide on our process, but I'll spend most of our time on what energy storage is and what the costs and benefits are and what the early lessons that we're learning through this process. So 2193, the ultimate objective of 2193 is to have the two utilities come back to the commission and propose energy storage projects. It, because it's a developing resource, the law directs staff and the stakeholders to spend a little time before they do that to gain a better understanding of some of the costs and benefits of storage. The law gives the commission some leeway in reviewing the projects from the utilities because in general, I think it's fair to say that storage hasn't reached the level of cost competitiveness, but there's a value in going forward with these projects and learning how they can value the system. The law says that storage systems under the process won't exceed 1% of load. The law also says, however, that the PUC can waive that cap if a storage system is a significant opportunity. There are only two states in the country that have energy storage mandates, California and Oregon. I would classify Oregon's version as cautious but forward-looking. You can see that we're looking at 39 megawatts for PGE, 26 megawatts for PacifiCorp. In California, they're looking to up their target to 1.2 gigawatts. So they're all in, and we're just trying to figure this out. So I think, again, this is we're going at the right speed, but we're learning how to do this. I will say Massachusetts just passed a law that directs their equivalent Department of Energy by the end of the year to determine whether or not to create an energy storage target. So the process is pretty simple. We're still in phase one. This is the stakeholders are trying to figure out what the values are and how to begin to quantify them. The law itself mentions some of the values that we're to look at, so that is deferred investment in generation, transmission, or distribution, reduced need for additional peak, improved renewable energy integration, reducing greenhouse gas emissions and improving the transmission and distribution system reliability. And phase two will come a little bit later, and that is the phase where the utilities will take all this back and look on their system to determine where the best places to make the investment on their system might be. So I don't have any pictures of batteries for you. That would be pretty boring. It would be a, steel box. And besides, we are electricity regulators, and so our graphics look like this. This looks sort of complicated, but it's really rather simple. The horizontal axis is the amount of energy that storage might, the various technology might offer into the system. The vertical axis is the length of time the energy could come onto the system from that technology. So, for example, if you look in the upper right, you'll see pumped hydro or compressed air. These are very large systems, very large and expensive systems. As you can see, they can offer a lot of energy onto the system, and they can do it for many hours at a time. If you go to the other end, to the lower left, I think that's right, lower left, you can see the flywheels, the nickel batteries, and they are the nickel metal hydride batteries. These are smaller energy resources that discharge over a very short amount of time, and they're really looking at being used for frequency regulation, instantaneous system balancing. The pumped hydro, for example, is for large-scale renewable energy integration, or even for arbitraging markets, filling the pond during low-cost hours and then using it during high-cost hours.
Can I stop you for a minute, Senator Jordan?
Yeah, we had a testimony a few years back about hydrogen technology with hydro, and I noticed that that's not on your little list up there, and it seems to me to be probably the most efficient way we could do it. And for those that don't know, you take the water molecule when it's not at peak time, you cleave it into hydrogen and oxygen, mix it with nitrogen, you form ammonia, and then you, during peak hours, you burn the ammonia. It's a closed loop. The byproduct is water, and that technology seems to be available, and it I would think it would be infinitely more cheaper than batteries, but I don't see it on your list up there, and I don't understand why.
Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, it's not on the list, I suppose, because this was limited to the batteries, and I don't think that technology would count as a battery, although that is a technology that has been discussed quite a bit. I remember probably 15, 16 years ago people talking to me about this. It's going to be one of those issues that I think is cost-related. So there is still a significant amount of research going into it. It just hasn't reached that cost point where it's becoming...
What I'm afraid of is we give subsidies like crazy to the power companies. And this and dams aren't... They don't own the dams. And so I hesitate. It bothers me when the obvious solution, which is a lot cheaper to do than to store it as batteries, isn't being discussed, because they'll own the batteries, but they'll charge it to the ratepayer.
They could own the other facilities too.
No, they don't. They don't own Bonneville.
But they could own the facilities that would use the Bonneville power to generate. They could, yeah. The ammonia generated, they could own those.
Oh, yeah, okay, I'll buy that.
They're up by the pump hydro. I suspect the reason it's not on the list is that EPRI is not looking at it.
Right.
EPRI is the research arm of the industry.
Senator Durant, I just think it's not classified as energy storage.
But why isn't it classified as energy storage?
I can't answer that question.
I mean, that's what it truly is.
So I guess I would say that the next slide is even more complicated than this one. But what it will, and I'll go to it now. I wouldn't actually have shown this to you, but my staff insisted. Apparently, this slide is becoming the thing to look at, and it's. it's you can look at this a couple of different ways, and I think it goes a little bit to Senator Rod's point, which is that storage, as folks are looking at, have numerous benefits on the system. And you can look at them, you can look at this slide as indicating that some of those benefits are at the customer level behind the meter. Some of them are at the utility level that would serve all customers. And some of them, the ISO is the independent system operator. That's regional transmission issues. So what people are beginning to do is looking at storage and looking at the appropriate places on the system where they provide value. With hydrogen, it may be that that is more of a generic size resource. It's not really fitting into this construct. These are particular values, I think, that storage is being developed to address, and we'll talk a little bit more about that.
So Jason, I'm assuming this is pretty small scale that you're dealing with now, but as things like the energy imbalance market develop out, being able to move power across the grid may actually limit the need for storage. Storage, probably, you know, people think of it as being able to solve long-term time problems, and really it's very narrow. It's more for regulating the system. At this point,
that's correct. I mean, there are, I think with the variable energy resources coming on the system, more solar and wind, there it is increasing the complexity of balancing, and there are a number of ways to begin to address that. One, as you said, is the energy imbalance market, which expands the footprint of the available resources to be able to integrate wind, for example. Another way is through technology like storage, which can work on a more localized basis. So I'm not sure there is a single answer. I think the issues are becoming a little bit more complicated, and people are looking at a wide variety of solutions, and storage is clearly one of the options.
I don't know if you know, the PGE has storage here in Salem that they discharged last year at a period of time. That was, how big is that? And when they discharged it, I'm under the impression it was just minutes of power that it generated.
Chair Meyer, I don't remember what the size was. I think it was a megawatt or less, but I'm not really sure. And it is in its minutes, and it helps with potential outage situations,
right,
and various regulation parts on the local part of the grid. It can island the grid, but as you say, for not very, very long. So let me actually turn to what we... I was going to give a real short example of the
benefit. Tell your chap that other chart, at least on the screen, is unintelligible.
Well, that's what I thought, but if you take some time, you can sort of examine the little pieces in there. And basically what it's saying is that there are different uses for energy storage that can go from the customer level to the transmission regional level. So I have two slides real quick. Just this is pretty high-level stuff on the values and costs of storage. And we use battery here, so it can be used for balancing. Improving system reliability, if you had storage, a battery associated with a substation, for example. And then the deferring additional investment. And then the bottom one is integration of resources. So if you paired up batteries with solar, for example, and if you generate more than you an individual uses during the daytime, you could store that. And then when the sun sets, you can draw from the battery at that point. So that's one of the sort of holy grails even at the residential level. I've seen some reports in the 2020s, there'll be a significant amount of residential load that could actually leave the system by pairing storage with solar. And I'm not sure that works in every state. I think that probably works better in some states than others.
Mm.
And on the cost side, the costs are pretty obvious. It's the capital costs of the unit, how the lifespan of the unit comes into play, the O&M, and then the cost of recharging that battery. So those are the. So we're in the process of sort of balancing this back and forth. I think just two more slides, lessons that we've learned so far. Some of this, in a sense, is obvious, but that doesn't mean we still don't need to learn it. The values are dependent on the location. So, for example, the example I just gave is, are you putting battery associated with PV, or is it associated with a substation? It can help with regulation and outage services, depending upon where it is on the distribution system. And you have to match the technology with the use you're looking at. Some of these some of these energy storage resources can have multiple uses, not necessarily at the same time, but over the course of a year. And so that value needs to be considered as well. And one of the things about this bill is that it is getting me and my staff to understand the values of storage better. It is prompting the utilities to have to understand it better. They're going to bring projects to us. And right now we're working very much on a collegial basis to, in a task force setting, in a work group setting, to understand this as a group, both stakeholders and the commission. And so next steps, finally, are that the commission just issued an order telling, sort of redirecting all the participants, the utilities, the stakeholders, and my staff to begin developing a list of specific applications, or called use cases, to develop methodologies to value the benefits of each of those applications, and to begin the approach to identify locations on the system. And then we turn it back over to the utility, where they're going to look on their own system, identify where on their system this energy storage may be of value, and at that point they will come back to the commission with a series of projects that the commission will review. So I'm happy to answer any more questions.
Jason, are we seeing any large industrial customers that are bringing on storage systems to reduce their demand charges? That's happening a lot in the Southwest.
I haven't seen that yet, Chair Byer. I know there is a lot of interest in at the industrial level of renewable energy, and storage may be a partner with renewable energy, so that may be.
Questions to Jason? You got your hands full.
I certainly do. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. All right, next up is a report on the economic impacts of climate change. And that is with gentlemen, welcome.
Because we didn't have electricity. We had a gasoline for a generator.
Jeez.
We created our own electricity.
Another slide up.
One of our presenters today had that slide. So. It's very good.
It's interesting stuff.
And that would run.
I think the technology is there. I think the incentives to buy it are not there. It doesn't get more than the
Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chair Byer, members of the Business and Transportation Committee. My name is Eric Wolgemuth. I'm joined here by Chris Dennett. We are members of Environmental Entrepreneurs, also known as E2. We're here today to provide a brief overview of our recent report, Oregon Changing Climate, Economic Impacts and Policies for Our Future. I think it's important to note that Chris and I are here as volunteers on our personal time. We are not being paid to represent any vested interests. In fact, actually, some of our E2 advocacy work rankles some of our business funders in the work that we do. So just want to point that out. This is a vacation day for me. The report I want to talk about really briefly synthesizes data from current research on the projected economic impacts from global warming to our state and region. Specifically, the economic implications. Oh, I need to do it that way. I'm doing it on my computer. Sorry about that. Thank you. You guys need to know where we are. I'll back up quickly. E2, national nonpartisan group of business leaders from every sector of the economy who advocate for smart policies that are good for the economy and the environment. The report synthesizes data from current research on the projected economic impacts from global warming to our state and region. Specifically, the economic implications of climate disruption to three key ecological systems upon which we rely for our healthy economy, specifically our hydrologic system, forests and farms, and our oceans. We shared copies of the report with your offices earlier in the week and back in July when the report was released. For you as policymakers, we see risks that can be mitigated and opportunities for job growth and economic development that can be encouraged through smart policies. So hope our insights will inform your thinking on future policies.
As for some key findings that you'll find in our report.
Could I ask you to put your name on the record, please?
Oh, sorry. My name is Chris Dennett, also a member of E2, resident in Portland, Oregon. Some key findings that we wanted to share for you today were related to our agricultural industries, outdoor recreation, and timber. The report anticipates some pretty dire consequences, both environmentally and economically. For example, cattle and calves or eastern Oregon wheat is largely a dry land product, and heat and drought has already contributed to harvest concerns over the last couple years. Outdoor recreation industry, such as the ski industry, is expected to continue to lose skier days on both the front and the back end of the ski season. With this comes jobs lost for those industries and a shortened season for a local retailer and their sales. This in turn impacts trout and salmon angling in Oregon, which is a well-known sport and recreational activity. Experiencing warmer waters and lower water levels could impact habitat. This in turn impacts guides, retailers, and the local rural economies that are expected to be negatively impacted by reduced participation in those activities. Reduced snowpack then becomes problematic for the agriculture industry, impacting irrigation. When it comes to our timber, number of acres burned in the report, we expect by 2080 to be expected to be increased by fourfold. Fourfold of the current annual acreage. That is a forecast of 600% increase in burned acreage in eastern Oregon. As we all know, the forestry industry contributes over $12 billion each year to Oregon. And as of 2013, our job numbers in Oregon from this industry were just over 58,000, down from 70,000 in the mid-70s. And as far as transportation and climate, increase in extreme precipitation events and weather will negatively impact transportation corridors, maintenance of roadways, these types of things. Authors of the report are expecting an increase in 13% increase in number of days with over an inch of precipitation per day. This number on the slide does not include money spent on emergency repair, which is sometimes as much as $100 million across the state annually. Not included in this report is the transportation sector is also one of the number one. Is now the number one contributor to greenhouse gas emissions, now behind electricity generation. Obviously, when roadways are closed in emergency situations like this, there's a negative impact to transportation corridors and the local economy in that way. And we have a lot of bottlenecks in Oregon where this is already a problem, which will only increase with the extreme precipitation events.
We'd like to touch on two economic opportunities. We're talking about some of the risks. Let's talk about the opportunities that Oregon's beginning to encourage but can do more with the right market-based policies, specifically as it relates to mass timber and clean energy. Both of these opportunities will generate job growth in both rural and urban areas in Oregon and hold great promise for accelerated growth. The building pictured here is a student residence hall now on the University of British Columbia campus. What's different is that this building is constructed of 16 stories of cross-laminated timber, wood, on top of two concrete stories. CLT, which is cross-laminated timber, which is basically glued together 2x4s, 2x6s, represents a significant market opportunity with the potential for job growth across a complex value chain from forest owners and managers to building owners and occupants. But what is driving demand for CLT is really a desire to mitigate climate change impacts from the building sector, which comprises about an estimated 40% of U.S. climate emissions. Two drivers of a building's greenhouse gas emissions is two big drivers of steel and concrete, which can now be replaced with wooden buildings potentially as high as 20 floors. And as builders learn how to work with the materials to optimize its load-bearing potential, that could even go higher. It's also some of the early studies are showing that as they get more comfortable with the technology, it'll actually can be put buildings up faster, so it actually will save them time and money as well, and the associated carbon emissions with trucks coming in and out of building sites. Mm-hmm. As the number one producer of softwood lumber in the U.S., Oregon's well-equipped to capitalize on this potential demand for mass timber. The right policy mix can mitigate potential timber losses from climate change and encourage the development of the CLT value chain in Oregon over time. Here's another example in Oregon, one of the first CLT or cross buildings with cross-laminated timber to be constructed. It's second in Southeast Clay and Portland's Industrial East Side District. It was opened this spring. The wood products keeps the carbon sequestered in the wood over the life of the building and the wood components themselves. One of the key things about this is, yes, when wood's burned or when it ultimately decomposes, those emissions are released into the atmosphere, but this is a much slower release of those emissions in the atmosphere. It's, in essence, carbon neutral. It reduces the use of steel and concrete, which I mentioned before, which emits significant carbon in their creation and use, saves time and money, as I mentioned before, and has some very good positive supply chain implications.
Another example of many in our report on the impacts of climate change, economic impacts of climate change for Oregon, is the clean energy and clean technology sector. Presently, the Oregon clean energy sector is $7 billion GDP and has growth rates twice that of other sectors. When compared to the fossil fuel industries, each $100 million investment creates just over 16 jobs, where the fossil fuel industry creates just over 5 jobs per $1 million invested. So addressing our climate challenge has not been the drain on the economy that was feared. Rather, it's a significant contributor to financial well-being in Oregon. Wind and solar have led the way, but continued advancements in wave and biomass are great opportunities for Oregon. We also need to be continually vigilant to ensure our rural communities benefit from this opportunity also. And then, as noted before, there's tremendous opportunity in reducing high emissions from our transportation sector, as is as I said, the now the greatest greenhouse gas source in the U.S.
That's what we came to
Thank you very much.
Any questions? Well, it looks like it's just you and me, right?
Oh, okay.
I'd like to start out by saying thank you very much for especially the part about timber. I think that if we look at greenhouse gas emissions, forest fires are huge, and if we could sequester the carbon, to me that's the low-hanging fruit to reduce our carbon footprint. But then again, I come from a timber-producing area. But we've had testimony before concerning that, and if you're from the East Coast, you talk about forest fires when you come out here. If you're from Oregon, that seems to get swept under the rug. But thank you. I the stuff about the buildings and how high we can go now with skyscrapers with timber, that's fascinating. And so that part of the program or your presentation, I really appreciate it. We're done.
We're done.
Unless you have something you want to say. They did a good job.
Great.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for taking me down. Thanks for taking a day of vacation to come in.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair.
All righty. Down to the last presentation. Trade and Shipping Development Act. Mr. Mannix, welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Kevin Mannix. I'm a Salem attorney. I'm here with Connor Harrington, who's an associate with my law firm. Although we are not here in our capacities as attorneys, we're really here in our capacities as the leaders of the Oregon Shipping Group, which is an advocacy group that we formed over the last few months to advocate for the enhancement of shipping in the state of Oregon in terms of the short term as well as in terms of the long term. There will be some slides running up there as I go along, but I'm not big on the audiovisual side of things, as the chair may remember. I will be adding a substantial color commentary as I go through this, but I'm also aware of the time limitations that the committee faces. The committee is asked to take a step back for a moment, and I'd like to speak to the Terminal 6 issue at the Port of Portland from a special perspective. And let me give you three cultural perspectives on this. First of all, there's a famous play, Waiting for Godot, although it's spelled G-O-D-O-T, by Samuel Beckett. In Waiting for Godot, Vladimir and Estragon wait endlessly and in vain for the arrival of someone named Godot. It's quite a play. I had to deal with it in college.
It's a boring play.
Our friends at the Port of Portland seem to be waiting for Godot in terms of the arrival of container ships. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about it. Let's look around. Where is Godot? Another cultural allegory that I'd present to you is a famous song by Dusty Springfield, Wishing and Hoping. And it was sort of brought back to us with the film My Best Friend's Wedding, starring Julia Roberts, where the entry presentation is these bridesmaids and bride performing to Wishing and Hoping. And again, it seems to me that some folks, some of our friends at the Port of Portland, are simply wishing and hoping that there will be the arrival or the return of container ships. And the third allegory occurred to me even earlier, and that has to do with a religious cultural thing. And out in the Pacific, the cargo cults. There was some cargo cult development before World War II, but World War II was the height of this, where natives on lightly inhabited islands spread out in the Pacific suddenly saw the arrival of these ships with manufactured goods. Men, largely some women, coming off the ships with food and cargo and all these wonderful things. And with limited education, some folks developed a belief that there was some god sending these ships, and that if you simply performed in the right way, the ships would arrive and everything would be fine. Well, we have a cargo cult going on at the Port of Portland, where I guess if you just keep wishing and hoping, or if you keep waiting for Godot, or you just keep praying, somehow container ships are going to return. And our position is it doesn't work that way. And there needs to be an active entity that is taking responsibility. And the active entity that we are recommending to the Legislative Assembly is the Oregon Shipping Authority. This triggers a broader conversation that I'll bring up, where as we got into the issue of Terminal 6, we realized the state does not have any entity which is designed to be entrepreneurial, to reach out to the business community and the community at large to say, what do we do to enhance shipping? Let's take a step back and look at the map of the United States and the West Coast. There's California, there's Oregon and Washington. Who are moving the goods? California and Washington. And what is Oregon doing? Wishing and hoping, waiting for Godot. So there's a broader issue here that begins to arrive. So we are talking about the creation of an Oregon Shipping Authority as a public corporation dedicated to reliable, predictable, and cost-effective freight shipping for the state of Oregon. You'll see that one trigger point in this discussion is container shipping at Terminal 6, but that is not the absolute essential to what we're talking about. I'm going to run through this introduction pretty quickly because this is a lot of information that you folks already have. But we put together the Oregon Shipping Group out of Common Sense for Oregon, which is a nonprofit that looks at taxes and government regulation. And we began this project first looking at Terminal 6. But as we got into this, we realized there are so many other infrastructure issues confronting us in the state. And I've seen some of the presentations today about the work we're doing on highways. But it involves barge shipping, seaport development, the connection of our short-line railroads to our long-line railroads. There's a host of issues. And our good friends at the Department of Transportation have a lot of information about this, but if you ask them, they are a regulatory agency, and then they oversee construction. It is not their job to be the visionary group that is looking at movement of freight, per se. So we've proposed the establishment of a public corporation with a focus on freight shipping. Now, I don't think I need to tell this committee about the importance of freight shipping. The statistics are right there in that slide, and of course that'll be available for the committee to think about and to discuss. But I do want to emphasize the next slide, which is the loss of container shipping capability. The Port of Portland actually has 7 multi-million dollar cranes. It has the capacity at Terminal 6 to have 3 medium-sized ships loading and unloading. And it has the actual capacity for around 700,000 container equivalents movement a year. In a peak year, 2003, it did move 339,571 TEUs. So we know that the Port of Portland can operate Terminal 6 successfully in a normal economy, and our friends at the ILWU can move ships and load and unload them. So the reality is that until a few years ago, this was a going thing. Understand, of course, that one of the issues was the depth of the channel up the Columbia River. So what did we do? We spent $183 million to deepen the channel to accommodate shallow draft but also medium draft vessels so we could still be in business. A good thing to do. But about that same time, when you look at the Terminal 6 background, the Port of Portland decided that they were losing some money on the operation of Terminal 6, and it was time to bring somebody else in. There was labor strife that occurred, but notice that the labor strife we're talking about is after 2010, not before. What happened, and I'm not blaming anybody here, I'm just talking about the history. In 2010, the Port of Portland brought in a private terminal operator, which doesn't operate any other terminals in the United States, brought them in under a request for proposal from the port, and they came in, I'll say, in good faith and signed a contract, signed a 25-year lease. But I want to pause and then say, well, with a 25-year lease, that tells me the Port of Portland has disengaged for 25 years in terms of responsibility for Terminal 6, which they still own, but which today moves zero containers, and yet the Port of Portland on their bottom line is doing just fine because they get $4.5 million every year for nothing. That's a nice landlord situation to be in if your mission is simply to bring money in. And I want to pause and also say the Port of Portland does many wonderful things. PDX is great. You know, I appreciate all the other things they do. But when we talk about Terminal 6, it is an absolute failure as of today because zero containers are moving in and out. And that's as of May of this year. Now, on the impact side, I think all of you are acquainted with the issues and the difficulty that has occurred. But I'd like to put this also in the Portland context, and I'm wearing my green tie today to remind me that this is a green issue also, because we have 1,700 trucks going through Portland up to Seattle and Tacoma to move shipping. We've got the carbon emissions issue. We have the carbon footprint. We also have the congestion issue. And I'm not blaming the trucking companies. They've got to do business. Somebody has to move this cargo. But we are not being cost-effective in terms of dollars for our shippers or cost-effective in terms of the environment by not solving the problem and using that terminal to move the goods. All right, Terminal 6 today. I've described labor disputes between ICTSI Oregon and the ILWU. They continue to play out in court. I'm not here today to resolve those disputes. They are there. But I want to take us back to the 1970s until 2010. Somehow we managed to keep moving traffic in and out of that port. And somehow we managed to help the Oregon economy by having containers move. And again, we had a nice peak year in 2003. It'd be nice to be anywhere close to that today. Then I want to emphasize something unique. The Port of Portland is owned by the state of Oregon. It's a state agency. And that is a significant element in terms of the potential for solutions. And I say potential because some of this potential should never be realized. The reality is that if you want to have a long-term capability to have a port, you need to have a port where you've worked with your labor force and you have labor peace. You have a port that's operated efficiently. You have a port that's designed to meet the needs of the shippers, both exporters and importers. And Oregon, as a net export state, needs to enhance imports so we have those containers coming in. There's a host of demographics and economic issues that affect us here, and we need to be aware of them. But we don't have any single entity right now that is looking at all those issues in terms of moving freight. So, what's our proposed solution? And it is not a replication of any existing entity. It is the creation of a new entity, a public corporation. The Oregon Trade and Shipping Development Act would, yes, one, we propose transfer the ownership from the Port of Portland to an Oregon Shipping Authority. You could decide not to do that, and I would argue that we still need the other elements of this act. There are many things that need to be done to help us develop a visionary plan for the future of Oregon. But we do think the initial focus, if you choose to give the Shipping Authority in effect, the ownership of Terminal 6 is make sure that we are loading and unloading container ships in a way that's predictable, reliable, and cost-effective. And I think it can be done. It's being done right now on the rest of the West Coast, but it's not happening in Portland. And you need to consider, why is that not happening? The Port of Portland, nice guys in many other ways, are simply wishing and hoping or waiting for Godot to solve this problem. They'll also say, oh, it's the international economy. Wait a minute. Container shipping volume is actually up 2% this year. Now, there's a terrible situation in terms of shipping because they've built 30% beyond capacity. They're over capacity at 30%. So they're fighting with each other for market share. They're losing money as they ship. Well, this ought to be a great opportunity for us to do something to enhance our capability to move shipping, because shipping lines really want to be able to move the goods. But there's something else. As we take a step back and we look at opportunities, we ought to be fostering the long-term development of the two critical seaports for the future of Oregon, Coos Bay and the mouth of the Columbia River. Portland, long-term, is a river port. It has started out as our seaport because the Willamette River used to be a major shipping line, and the Columbia River was a major shipping line, and they came together at Portland, so it was convenient to have the center of shipping be in Portland. But now we're talking about a Columbia River channel that cannot accommodate the largest ships, and never will, unless you want to blast bedrock, and I don't think that's going to happen. So let's take a look at what we can do to enhance development around the Astoria-Warrenton area and in Coos Bay. And a shipping authority can be given that opportunity without interfering with the local port operations. It needs to be supportive, not regulatory, a public corporation that has the powers of the state but the flexibility of entrepreneurs. And we've mentioned from time to time that Oregon Health and Sciences University, as a public corporation since 1995, has been a great success story. Our conversion of SAFE into SAFE Corporation as a public corporation has been great, as providing underlying guarantees of good workers' compensation coverage with good benefits for workers with limited litigation. So there are times when we've turned to public corporation models and we've done good things. We think comprehensive freight planning is also one of the obligations of this shipping authority. The reality is, as I've traveled around the state and talked to folks in different communities, there's no real outreach to put together planning to connect those communities up with a shipping network. So one of the things we want to do is provide that systemic connection throughout the state. And I'll mention as an example, in terms of comprehensive thinking, we have about $100 million in Connect Oregon money, which has been distributed, or is being distributed as we speak. That's good. But there's been no comprehensive plan developed about how that those pieces of Connect Oregon monies should be used to fit into a comprehensive shipping network. Now, governance is a significant issue here. I've been a bit critical of the Port of Portland. I'll apologize to our friends from the Port of Portland who are here. They're doing their job, but actually, they are fulfilling the mission the legislature gave them. Here's the quote from the legislature, ORS 778.015. The object, purpose, and occupation of the Port of Portland shall be to promote the maritime, shipping, aviation, commercial, and industrial interests of the port, not of the state of Oregon, not to systemically support the development of shipping capabilities. They're given a limited mission, and actually they're fulfilling that mission. Even in terms of Terminal 6, hey, they're making $4.5 million a year profit. Granted, nothing's moving. And I'm being a little sarcastic when I say that, but in reality, as a totality, they have a limited mission. We're talking about the Oregon Shipping Authority having an expansive mission with limited power, but the capability to develop plans and bring them to the legislature for adoption, and to work with the private sector sometimes to support and enhance private sector projects that will support our shipping network. We also are proposing a different model for the directors of this public corporation.
12 directors appointed by clusters of county commissioners throughout the state. So there is accountability by each of the directors to county commissioners, who in turn are directed in this legislation to consult if they have a port within their county, and there are lots of local ports with port officials who are usually locally elected, to consult with them about who ought to be directors of this shipping authority. In this sense, you've created an expansive and accountable directorship, which would then select a president as a CEO, as an executive director for the entity. I think I'm keeping the timing going pretty well, Mr. Chairman.
Isn't that fine?
I do have some other information here that I'll just share with you in terms of rail. One of the things that blew my mind when I got into this was looking at, we have 20 short line railroads in the state, and yet the Oregon Department of Transportation has a wonderful railroad section. They have tons of good information, but they're a regulatory operation. It's not their job to go out there and say, how do we help expand these lines? How do we help connect these lines? An Oregon Shipping Authority can step in and say, let's talk about this. And I'm careful about mentioning examples publicly, but here's a very good one. The Port of Coos Bay had the moxie to acquire their rail line, their 100-year-old rail line that runs to Eugene. They've had the moxie to raise the money and get help from the legislature to build up that line, and they just got an $11 million grant from the U.S. Department of Transportation because they have 9 tunnels that are too small to accommodate double-stack container railroad cars, and now they have the money to expand those tunnels. They still are going to need help with strengthening their rail bed, straightening it out, enhancing the capability of the rail bed to hold weight, all of these things. And an Oregon Shipping Authority from a statewide perspective ought to be saying, what can we do to help? How do we support the Port of Coos Bay in this mission? That is the kind of thing where we can make a difference. And I have to mention, even though we've moved to the next slide, before we talk marine, think about the Columbia River. We have got the best east-west connection in the western United States when we have the Union Pacific running on the south side of the Columbia River, and we've got the Burlington Northern running on the north side of the Columbia River. It's basically flat sea-level transportation links. And where do they go right now when they come? If they're heading west, they go north to Seattle, Tacoma, or they may turn south towards California for export. How about us returning Portland into that equation, and later on, the mouth of the Columbia River, and enhancing Coos Bay as export and import terminals? There are also the potential for intermodal facilities around the state, so that especially in agriculture, but also manufacturing, there's a capability to have short line trucks bring in the containers and then put them onto rail cars where you consolidate, create the 108 unit trains, so that the long lines then are willing to move them wherever that needs to go. Environmentally friendly, reduces the load on our highways generally, and at the same time, if it's done right, reduces costs for our shippers, which enhances our capability to be competitive. And I want to mention barge traffic, because there is still an unlimited capability of the Columbia River to move barges, and if we had a seaport at the mouth of the Columbia River that could accommodate barges bringing whether it's bulk or containers to that seaport, there's another way that we can move goods, not just from Oregon, but from Idaho. We can connect up by rail and by the Snake River up into Washington. There's a tremendous potential in the Northwest. Being real important here politically, though, at the bottom of this marine, letting those ports define their own missions. We do not want to get in the way of our local ports with their elected port commissioners. We may want to see some additional ports created as we go along, because I think that could enhance Oregon's capability to have local folks be in charge of what's happening in their community. But we certainly don't want to get in the way of the existing ports. And finally, in terms of modes of transportation, we've got trucking. Our trucking industry is filling a gap right now, and we should be thankful for that. But we need to help them, too. Our regulatory scheme in terms of the insurance code needs to be addressed to see how we can help younger drivers qualify for insurance coverage, how we help provide additional training programs, education programs for truck drivers right here in Oregon. How do we enhance that through our community colleges, for example. But we need those driver education programs, and we need to revisit the insurance code to make it friendly, not stupid, but friendly in terms of how we address young drivers so that we enhance their opportunity to get those jobs. And I'd like to add this. If we've worked successfully with our trucking industry so that a lot more of those jobs are jobs where you can be back home in the evening, it's family friendly, where you're not going to be gone for 2 weeks at a time. You may be gone for a couple of days, but the moderate haul loads will get you to the rail lines, and then the rail lines can move the product. There's a real potential there, but we need to support our trucking industry in addressing some of the challenges they face. And I'll mention one minor example that can be substantial. The Oregon Department of Transportation allows each of its regions to impose additional permit requirements for long hauls and wide hauls, I mean long loads and wide loads. We need to revisit that, because if you're moving through Oregon and you have a permit from ODOT, it ought to be good anywhere unless there's a particular road that has a particular problem. And let ODOT define that at the outset. But there are delays when there are supplemental permit requirements which can impede the profitability, in fact, may eliminate the profitability of some of our businesses which need to move cargo by truck. Phew. So my concluding remarks is I think passage of an Oregon Trade and Shipping Development Act is necessary to enhance our capability, taking a look at our geographic position on the West Coast, and maintaining our capability to be God's country. If our freight shipping system works, our farmers can still be productive and profitable, and we can maintain that open space. How do we maintain agriculture? This is one of the ways we help them stay where they are, because they are environmentally friendly and they give us open space. But if they feel they can't make a living because of the cost of transportation and transportation infrastructure limitations, we've hurt our opportunity to maintain our role, in my view, as God's country. A public corporation focusing on all of this is not God's gift to God's country, but does give us a vehicle for improving things. And as I wrap up, I want to mention again, we're not proposing that we be locked into any particular kind of solution to the Terminal 6 situation. We do think the Terminal 6 situation has caused a tremendous amount of political interest in a solution. And as we're developing that solution, let's find a solution that allows us to address a host of other issues around the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Captain. Questions? Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This all sounds very good. Sounds great. What I want to know is, what does it cost and how is it paid for?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Riley, if I may be so bold, if the Oregon Shipping Authority is given the ownership of Terminal 6, it immediately gets $4.5 million a year that the Port of Portland is presently getting. That's one part. And of course, the idea is, though, you want to change that situation so containers are moving. The second part of it is that there may need to be some seed money to get this started. But over time, as projects are developed and grants are sought, a percentage of the grants may go to fund the Oregon Shipping Authority. And I'll make this up, but for example, if the Oregon Shipping Authority had helped the Port of Coos Bay get that $11 million federal grant, perhaps they would have received some small part of that as part of their administrative support. I'm making that up, and that's an historic situation. But as they are helping communities get funding, but I'm not kidding. At the beginning, I can't kid myself, we would need some seed money from the legislature, but it would be a small amount, and this is separate from Terminal 6. But you would need the seed money to have a staff of perhaps 6 to 8 people, and that's where legislative fiscal would have to evaluate how to do that.
More? Anybody else? Senator Monroe, and then you.
Yeah, Kevin, thanks a lot for your presentation. A lot of the things that you touched on, I've been thinking about for a long time. How do we get containers back to Terminal 6? It's critical. It's just stupid that all of that, here we sit as a major transportation hub of this whole region with barges and rail and trucks all converging, and yet we don't do containers anymore, and they all head up to Tacoma and Seattle. That's troublesome. The other thing that you touched on, I've been thinking a lot about because of my background in education, is why don't our community colleges have training programs for truck drivers when there's a dearth of truck drivers right now? And I've looked at that a little, and there's only two of our 17 community colleges that provide any kind of truck driver training. That's troublesome to me. And they say, well, but the law somehow, if there's a private truck driving school in the vicinity, then the community college can't do that. So maybe we need to change the law, because I think there ought to be education programs to train young truck drivers in every community college. That's what community colleges are for, is job development. And those truck drivers are all getting older. Some of them are almost as old as I am. And you know, we've got a real shortage. So, you know, a number of things that you talked about I think are very interesting. Coos Bay will never replace the Port of Portland. Sure, can be expanded. I voted to help them get the rail connection to Eugene. I think that's a good move, and I think we need to do more to enhance that. But the hub of transportation for the whole Pacific Northwest is right in Portland, and we need to recognize that and enhance it.
Senator?
I have a comment and a question. First, I love the presentation. I agree with my colleague on my left here that Coos Bay is kind of the diamond in the rough, which is kind of in this report, and that we can be doing a lot better down in Coos Bay. And I also believe for certain ships that Astoria or thereabouts is another port that we can be looking at as far as the improving the port. Kevin, you and I discussed, I mean, you have in your report about trucking, and my colleague on the left is always telling me about all the transportation problems going up into Portland. But we talked about a transfer station, and you had some interesting information about the city of Lebanon. Would you share that with the rest of the group?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Girard, I'm happy to do that. One of the things we did as we visited around the state was we discerned that the Lebanon community was looking very hard at developing what I'll call a transload facility within Lebanon. And they are in an ideal position as we looked at it. And we actually, I sat down at a meeting with 15 members of that community and looked at the maps and heard from them. The sort of thing I would hope the Oregon Shipping Authority might do someday is go out in the communities and listen and talk it through. We met for 3 hours and discerned ultimately the Albany and Eastern Railroad is a short line railroad. It's one of the few in the United States that connects with two long lines, the Union Pacific and the Burlington Northern in Albany. They run east into Lebanon. In Lebanon, they have a line that runs right alongside some major industrial complexes. They also run right alongside a 47-acre site, which would be ideal for a transload facility. Then we find out it's inside the urban growth boundary. It's inside the city limits. It's zoned industrial. Wetlands mitigation has occurred. The county commissioners like it. The city likes it. The city says this is shovel-ready for permits within 2 months. And so it's a premier site. We're awaiting. Business Oregon received a $100,000 appropriation to do a marketability study. We're awaiting the results of that. I very much believe that they're going to be very favorable about the prospects for such a facility. Now, there are about 3 other sites in the southern Willamette Valley which are also potentials for this. But what I've discerned is the city of Lebanon's got its act together, and they're moving pretty aggressively and want to be in line. Well, what was important was understanding, as you talk to the Albany and Eastern Railroad, for example, that they're on board because obviously it brings them business. Now there have to be conversations with Union Pacific and Burlington Northern, but already legally the connection is there. And I have to add something else. The Willamette Valley Railroad runs from Woodburn to Silverton, Mount Angel, Staten. It doesn't quite get down to Lebanon, but if it did, all the farmers in that area could be putting their product onto containers and short-haul trucks, and they'd be able to get them on on rail into Lebanon to build up those 108-unit trains. What I'm getting at, there's a real dynamic for us to be able to enhance short-haul trucking, use existing rail lines, and that transload facility has tremendous potential. And that's just an example of conversations that have started as a result of this process. I would love to see a public corporation which is enhancing those discussions. And one other thing, if I may, Mr. Chair, I went to Ontario, and the Ontario area, the farmers and the community have their act together. They have four potential transload facilities which they're putting together, and I think the Joint Committee went out to visit.
We saw them.
They've got their own thing going. They don't need anybody's help. And God bless them. So in that sense, that community already had it going. But there still is no state entity to say, how can we help you in massages? I want to say quickly, ODOT is wonderful about providing information, and they do their regulatory job. It's not their job to do this stuff. But we think there ought to be someone who does have this job.
More?
No, I'm good.
Yeah. Actually, we're looking forward to that. That's one of the reasons we commissioned that study, was to find out whether actually it was feasible to do one or not. And we have the same discussion going underway in Eastern Oregon. More? Well, thank you, Kevin. As always, a very interesting idea and good presentation.
Thank you.
Is that, Mr. Chair?
Is that it?
Yeah.
Anything else for the good of the committee?
Hit the gavel.
Good of the order. We're done. We're done.